economic growth crushed expectations this morning. GDP hitting 3% for the third quarter, despite the impact from not one but two deadly hurricanes.
Well, it is. In the most recent quarter, I think we would have been well over 3% except for the hurricanes.
It's the first time since 2014 that we've had back-to-back quarters of 3% plus.
Fed officials puzzled by how inflation has remained below 2% while the economy continues to grow.
You've got amazing job creation. Business is eager to get things going with the tax reform.
White House unveiling new research that shows that their tax proposal would boost GDP by 3 to 5% over baseline in the long run.
You're finally seeing fundamentals on the economic and on the corporate side meeting those expectations. So this is a great day for the market.
Yeah, Amazon, Microsoft, Alphabet, all-time highs, new highs today. Incredible.
Unbelievable levels there.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
What a week it was. We just got economic numbers out Friday. The economy grew at 3.1% for the third quarter, despite those hurricanes. 3% economic growth now back to back, something we haven't seen in over 8 years. We have oil prices breaking out. And speaking of breaking out, we've got stocks at record levels. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in hour one will be Richard Dixon from Lowry's. He's saying this market is firing on all cylinders. Doesn't matter where you're looking. The Dow, the S&P, the transports, the Russell, small, mid-cap, all of them going. And there's nothing on the horizon that says that this trend can't continue. He'll be joining me, and along with Kurt Wolf, as we talk about oil, as oil breaks out on this Friday, almost $54 a barrel, breaking through that $52 level. And Kurt says it's changing in the energy industry. Companies are now emphasizing shareholder value. So it's show me the money with Kurt Wolf. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be joining us in hour one as we take a look at what moved the markets this week. All of that in our first hour.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, a popular investment is municipal bonds. Of course, they are guaranteed by government entities such as the states. Have you looked and checked and see how solvent or how much in reserves the states have against these bonds? We're going to do that this week. Credit risk is the topic. We've discussed the risk of subprime auto loans and everything else. Now we're going to look at various states and see whether or not they are a liability for your investments and then what that means for investors. Then next, we have a rising economy. The government's telling us we're over 3% for the third quarter in terms of economic growth, something, by the way, we haven't seen in 8 years. And also the stock market continues to hit new highs, but as it does, economic growth accelerates and the demand for oil goes up. So what does that mean for oil? Do we expect higher oil prices? And if so, what does it mean for investments? All of that today on the big picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And first we go to Ryan Poplava here. It's time to review the catalysts and drivers this week, Ryan, which led to such an impressive rally as the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and the S&P 500 hit yet another record high this week. Wow. Ryan, can you tell us what led the major averages to fresh highs? Was it earnings, economics, monetary, fiscal policy, what?
Yeah, actually, there was some profit-taking early in the week, maybe on some earnings, but we did rally strongly back on Friday. But yeah, it was definitely a very busy week on all fronts, John. So looking at the earnings season, we're in full force this week, and we also will be as well next week. Economics, we had quite a few numbers that came out this week that were really important, but didn't really add too much more to the conversation, but it was mainly earnings that drove such a huge rally on Friday. And that was really in the tech area of things. I mentioned last week that as a result of all of the technology companies, the bellwethers that were going to be announcing at the end of Thursday after the market closed, and a long list of important companies on Friday morning with some energy names, that Friday was going to be a major day, and it didn't disappoint. So looking at the names that really drove things, it was Amazon, Alphabet, Intel, Microsoft, and to some extent also Twitter, which announced that they believe they're going to turn a profit at the end of the fourth quarter. And so that jacked the price up quite a bit. All told, Looking at the NASDAQ closed Friday up 2.2%. That's just ginormous. I didn't take a look to see what kind of a rise that was versus the past. You know, how long have we seen such a huge increase like that all in one day? And it was just a combination of all of these really huge bellwether names that are driving the future in cloud computing, in Microsoft, in retail, Amazon, the major disruptor that it is. And Intel announced and started talking quite a bit about artificial intelligence. Also this week, though, John, it wasn't just earnings. The European Central Bank announced their policy changes, which we should get into here, I guess, because of its immediate effect on currencies. The ECB decided to leave rates where they are, unchanged. No real surprise there. But they did announce that they'll be lowering their purchase program from 60 billion euros down to 30 billion a month, and that's going to start in January. But what they've done is they've also extended that they're going to continue to buy bonds all the way out to September of next year. So they are scaling down their purchases while also extending the program. So it was still what was interpreted as a very dovish move. Additionally, John, the president, Mario Draghi, when he was talking to his press conference to all the journalists there, he said that QE would likely be extended beyond September. So he added a little bit more color than just the opening policy remarks, and that affected the euro quite a bit. The euro dropped down towards, I think it was around 116, 117, right around that area versus the dollar. And if you look at it technically, 115, so one spot 15 against the dollar is a very key level that was a breakout recently a couple of months ago and should act as support. If we break down below that, I think you're going to see the dollar rally even more and the euro break down much further, but we'll have to see. That's a key level to watch.
Well, it does seem that the drop in the euro had a large effect on the dollar, causing it to rally with some technicians calling for a bottom. So what's your opinion? Will you make any adjustments if the dollar continues to strengthen?
The dollar strength this week wasn't only based on the move in the euro, playing off of the European Central Bank policy shift, though it was a major catalyst. There was also strength based on the Republican House passed the same budget that the Senate passed. So what we have now is complete agreement. We've been talking about that for the past couple of weeks on the budget for 2018, paving the way for the Republicans to pass a tax reform bill with a simple majority, not what they typically need would, in this case, would be a 60 vote threshold in the Senate. And that's really where, you know, the control isn't as solid for the Republican Party in Congress. So will we adjust our holdings? Your question? Probably not, because the valuation metrics we follow, what has caused us to move out of some of the U.S. instead of being entirely U.S. like we were over the past 3-4 years. Those valuation metrics haven't changed all that greatly. And if the dollar just does this intermediate rally, you know, that's not going to shift our long-term play, which is a year to 2 years out from now, where we still want to be heavily invested both in the U.S. and also globally, because that's where we're seeing the growth in economics, the growth in also market performance. We're seeing it globally. So no, this change, I don't think, is going to really radically reverse the currency trends that we've been following.
You know, and things continue to look good here as well. So what can you tell us about the economic numbers from this week?
The biggest announcement this week was the first estimate for third quarter GDP. That was announced on Friday, coming in at an annual rate of 3%. But this was based on what we call incomplete data, as the Bureau calls it. And we won't see a more complete reading of the GDP report until about a month from now, November 29th. So they're going to revise it likely. But still, we have the second quarter now. The final number was right around 3%, 3.1, I think. And here we are, third quarter at 3%. That's two great quarters above our average. And that was another solid number that helped the market rally on Friday. But digging into the number, we're wanting to do that here just to see what's going on. Growth was driven by inventories. So inventories were built up. We've been talking about manufacturing. Manufacturing's been firing on all cylinders. What did drop was sales. Sales decelerated from 2.9% last quarter down to 2.3. The average, though, John, is right around 2.4. So we're not all that concerned about it. And a lot of it maybe was a result of the hurricane disruption on the south, on activity there. But regardless, you know, it's right there near the average. So again, like I said, we're not that concerned. Maybe as things progress in the fourth quarter, as we've already seen in some of the economic numbers, they look great on the soft data on the manufacturing side of things. So the other number I'd like to point out on the economic side was the durable goods report on Wednesday, because that's hard data. That's not soft data. It's not the surveys like, oh yeah, we feel orders are coming in. They look good. We're positive about this quarter. No. Durable good reports are right there, hard data, that the actual results, and it showed that durable goods rose 2.2%, and that's more than what the consensus was thinking, was right around 1.3%. So that was a great number. Didn't really have a whole effect on the market that I could see when that was announced on Wednesday, but what I do like to see is that this is hard data that is now confirming all that manufacturing survey soft data strength that we've been seeing, and like I just talked about last week with the Philly Fed and the Empire surveys I mentioned. There was one more number, the University of Michigan consumer sentiment. Sentiment's really important, driving consumption. How positive are consumers? Are they about the current economy, or where they think where the future economy is going to be is going to drive a lot of their spending activity? We're a consumption-driven economy. So very important number, came in at 100.7. And basically, it did drop slightly from, I think, 101. But we haven't been up this high near 100 since like 2004, I think. And then since the post, the record, right with the bull market in 2000, that was a secular bull market. There was a parabolic end to technology stocks at that point. Things crashed. People were well exposed to stocks at that point. Where was sentiment? You know, we're right around where we're at right now. So people feel really good about the economy. The other thing is that when we look at correlations with how do consumers feel about the economy, looking at this sentiment indicator, it's highly correlated with the valuation metrics on the S&P 500. So the PE going up on the S&P 500 directly correlated with how consumers feel about the economy. Those two, as long as sentiment's going up, likely we're going to continue to see valuation metrics for the S&P continue to go up. So that's one reason why I bring that up. And also, you know, just to show our listeners where do things stand on sentiment for consumption.
Yeah. You know, Ryan, do people at Financial Sense Wealth Management believe that things are starting to get a little frothy? I mean, especially if you look at, say, for example, valuations for Amazon.
You know, John, investors are looking at Amazon and treating it as a growth company. You know, it's good that I'm not hearing analysts say, you know, clicks are going up, you know, anything like that. But you look at everything that they're doing. They're the major disruptor. Jim has talked about that many times this year, and others like Amazon that are disrupting industries. Look at Grubhub and some of these convenience oriented companies that are kind of revolutionizing things. You look at Walmart. Walmart's now delivering. Costco is delivering door to door on products at their cost. So Amazon, yes, they're not that young. And more certainly looking at how things are going for them. And they're looking more like a startup at their growth rate. And recently we heard that they are now looking at agreements with states to start distributing pharmaceuticals and getting into that industry. Obviously, we see Amazon is the great disruptor. There's no doubt. Valuations are what they are. Are we looking at their profits? They really didn't move all that much, but you know, they're growing on sales. We just had in-house, actually on Friday, Dave Nikoski, Chief Investment Officer at Vermilion, and we were talking about that. You know, where is this bull market going? Dave does a lot of sector work, a lot of industry work in his technical analysis of things. And he says, you know, typically when a bull market ends, it ends in that frothiness. It ends in that excitement, parabolic moves where you're getting 20 to 30% well above these long-term moving averages. And that was the case for the NASDAQ, right? In 2000. And many of our listeners probably know this back in 2011. Gold was the same way. I wrote an article about it in August of 2011 being parabolic and saying, be careful. I did the same thing in silver. So if you want to look at anything being frothy, in my mind, I brought it up about a month ago, Bitcoin. That's the one thing that's, you know, it's rising parabolically. There's a lot of excitement there. Warren Buffett even talked about it this week. Although Warren Buffett was wrong about it in 2014. And then we talked about with Ray Dalio and how, what his sentiment is. He's not buying right now, but in the future he does want to buy. It's impossible to say, John, whether this is the top for Bitcoin, but I can definitely tell you that people are very excited about it, and big moves drive that attention, and that attention drives investment, and then drives over investment. So that's for me right now. If I see anything out there that's feeling to me a little frothy or parabolic, it's Bitcoin. And I generally stay away from investments like that. And I actually told my brother to get out about a month ago. And it's just for me, I want to look for opportunities elsewhere where there's not as much excitement in it. And where I see that, it's energy. Jim's talked about it in September. I said he's like a boy in a candy shop because things look attractive. And that was the same thing for me in January of last year in commodities. I was buying Freeport at $5. So is there frothiness? And I was going back to what Dave and I were talking about. Dave mentioned in his recent rounds, most managers he's run into are staying away from energy. And he's saying, hey, we've got this bottom formation that's starting. Generally, if we break out above $60, what he thinks and what I also agree with, then I think we're looking at some excitement stirring its way towards energy. So is there frothiness in the tech stocks? I wouldn't say so. I'd say it's still some disruptions happening there. New markets are happening. New ways of delivering products are happening. That's exciting. And that's what's driving business there. So no, I don't think it's frothy yet.
Okay, then. No parabolic moves yet in stocks. Of course, this allows for more room for this bull market to go, especially, too, as we have yet to see how well the market will respond if a tax reform bill is actually passed in Congress in the months ahead. So anything else? Any Halloween surprises for the market?
The FOMC is going to be meeting next week, but nobody expects anything really in the
message. No horror stories is what you're telling me.
No horror stories, right, nothing scary, no booze, no surprises, no ghosts. But likely, you know, the anticipation continues to be fairly high for a rate hike in December. Janet Yellen staying the course. The only surprises right now that we'll probably get, I think it might be next week, Trump should be announcing fairly soon who the next chairperson will be. And there's a lot of rumors going back and forth between Taylor and Jerome, but you know, who's to say where it's going to go, but it'll be very important. A lot of people feel that if Taylor gets put in, that the Fed will start being a little bit more aggressive. So it is an important decision, and that's definitely something I'll be watching. And then, of course, earnings season is still here, and we're right in the thick of it. So no other trick-or-treats for us for now.
Sounds good. All right, Ryan Poplava, good to hear from you, and look forward to you again next week.
We'll see you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
In our latest investor newsletter, we're trying to explain the paradox of investing after over 8 years of quantitative easing and loose monetary policy. And this paradox is that we're in a world where most assets are overvalued. So in a world where almost everything looks like a bubble, the definition of bubble has to be changed. You have to try to invest in the assets which look the least overvalued, or at least the ones that are not going to pop if monetary policy takes away its support from the market. So monetary policy has created this very conducive environment of low interest rates, of easy forward guidance for investors to keep buying assets which have a yield. Effectively, what investors have done is buying stocks for dividends and buying bonds for capital gains, which is something that normally doesn't make sense. Now, we are starting to see an improvement in the job market, very slow. We're starting to see growth even in Europe, even in the periphery. And there are chances that monetary policy could turn away from being so loose. And that's when we try to understand the assets which the boats that will remain high even when the tide comes out, and the boats that will fall down.
Here we are on Friday, and once again, it's another broken record as stock markets break out to all record highs across the board, no matter where you're looking, whether it's industrial stocks, the S&P, the NASDAQ, or even the Russell. Joining us on the program from Lowry's Research is Richard Dixon. And Richard, before we begin talking about the indexes, let's talk about your two key indicators, which is buying pressure and selling pressure. What are those indicators telling you right now about this uptrend?
They're telling us that we've got a very healthy uptrend going on right now. You know, buying power is our primary measure of demand, selling pressure of supply. And obviously, when you have rising demand and falling supply, you're in sort of an ideal situation. And that's exactly what we have right now. Our buying power index has been trending higher all the way back to the November low last year, and selling pressure has been trending lower over that same period of time. So on an intermediate term basis, you're sort of in the ideal position in the market right now with expanding demand and contracting supply.
Is this typically what you see in the final phases of a market? Usually you see somewhat of a melt up. It seems like that's what this has been. I mean, going back to the election, it's been nothing but straight up.
This is, I think, arguably the longest period we've gone, certainly since the rally from late 1994 through 1995. The longest the S&P in particular has gone without as much as a 3% pullback. So this has definitely been sort of an unremitting climb. Of what has been perhaps a little bit unique about this market has been the really lack of selling. We have had a number of large declines in the Dow, 250 points, and none of them have really been followed through by any significant selling. In some cases, the market's immediately reversed and headed higher. Probably the best example of that was the sell-off back in the middle part of May, where we had a big drop in the Dow, and didn't last. The market immediately rallied back up to new highs. So that really has been, I think, from a historic standpoint, the most unique aspect of this rally, the fact that there has just been no follow-through on any significant down days that the market has experienced.
Are you seeing, Richard, something that is reminiscent of what we saw between 1998 and 2000? Anytime the market was pulling back, and we had a couple pullbacks, the Asian crisis, we had a one-day pullback, and then, of course, the bankruptcy of long-term capital management and Russian default, that was a one-day pullback. But back then, the thinking was buy the dips. So are you seeing any kind of pullback that you see your buying pressure come in and it strengthens? In other words, any kind of dip whatsoever, you see more money coming in the market?
No, this market really has very little in common with the markets, say, in 1999 and up to the highs in the S&P and the NASDAQ in March of 2000. It's really a contrast, not comparison. If you want to make any kind of parallels at all, it's the, you know, the fact that lately you have had a handful of Dow stocks that have been driving the Dow Jones higher and outperforming the S&P, for instance, in the New York. Today, obviously, we have sort of a resurrection of several of the FANG stocks that are really vaulting both the S&P and NASDAQ to new highs. But really, when you look at the run-up to the highs in 2000, you had an advanced decline line, which had peaked in April of 1998 and was actually at its lows at the time of the market peaking in, choose what you want, the Dow in January and the S&P and NASDAQ in March. At the same time, when you're talking about buying power and selling pressure, the buying power was not in any kind of uptrend. It was moving lower, and selling pressure was basically erratic, but there was really no consistent contraction in selling. You had some, I'd say on balance, you had a rough increase in selling pressure, even though it was a rather erratic move. So, you know, in terms of the key measures of market strength, breadth, and balance of supply and demand, this market is absolutely nothing like what we had in 1999 and early 2000.
Let's talk about the advanced decline line. I know you track a different one that kind of removes some of the distortions of interest rate type of stocks on the exchange. Is that showing a backup or, let's say, support for these advances? In other words, across the board, everything is rising?
Well, prior to today, the S&P had made a new high on October 20th. Our operating companies only, Advanced Decline Line, made a new high same day. We also look on a segmented basis. We feel as though it's important to see what the large, mid, and small cap segments of the market are doing in addition to the broad-based Advanced Decline Line. And both the large and the mid-cap AD lines are making new highs right along with the underlying indexes. The small cap had not, but that's simply a reflection of the fact that the small cap indexes have not made new highs. So in terms of breadth, both on a broad-based basis, on a segmented basis, this market is continuing to show very significant strength.
So do you see anything on the horizon? I mean, everybody's excited about where the market is now and where it's been since November. In your estimation, how long does this continue? I mean, could we see another year of this, another 2 years of this, kind of like what we did, in fact, see between 98 and, let's say, the first part of 2000, where things just kept accelerating when you thought they could go no higher, they just kept going.
It's not really our practice to try to forecast, you know, how long is something going to go on, how high is it going to go. Basically, all we can do is look at the current market conditions and say that whether they're conducive to further gains or whether they're not. And right now, they're conducive to further gains. So, you know, how far does this go? It'll go until we see signs, or we certainly hope that we're going to see signs, the deterioration that would suggest a significant top is in the process of forming. When that happens, could be later this year, you know, in December. It could be next year, first, second, third, fourth quarter next year. We don't know. All we know at this time is that we see no signs of weakening in the market's primary intermediate term uptrends. And as such, you know, we have to see that prices are going to continue to move higher.
Now, you guys have been doing this for well over 70 years. When you look at a, let's say, topping process with the kind of things that you follow, which right now you're telling me there's nothing out there that you see, but what would you want to see that would tell you or alert you that there could be trouble?
Well, I mean, basically, you have to go on historic precedents. We've examined every major market top going back to 1929. And, you know, these things all share common characteristics. One of the key ones, obviously, is you see a pattern, certainly of rising supply. Demand sometimes can actually rise into the final high, but it's that increase in selling that really determines that you are now in the process of putting in a very significant top. That should be accompanied by signs that buyers are becoming much more selective in terms of what they are, what they're buying. That is reflected in a lagging or diverging advanced decline line. You know, these things have occurred time and time and time again. You know, to say, well, this time is different, we all know how, you know, useful those four words are. So we have to go by the historic precedent, and that's the sort of thing we'd be looking for. It's not there right now.
Yeah, because typically when you come back from summer, usually the first part of September traditionally has been a very weak part of the year. September, maybe early October, we have seen nothing of any pullback. As you mentioned, we haven't even had a 3% pullback.
No, we have a little bit of a 2% or so in the first part of late August, early September, but that's been it.
Yeah. So you don't see anything on the horizon. So this thing sounds like it's liftoff. In terms of other markets, is there anything that stands out in what you're seeing now compared to, like you said, this doesn't look anywhere near what it looked like between 1998 and 2000 when you had the advanced decline line falling? What makes this market different, in your opinion, as you've followed these bull markets over the years?
As I said, you know, the earlier on, the real defining characteristic of this market, certainly since over the past year, has been a lack of selling. The fact that you get pullbacks and then there's no follow through whatsoever. Obviously, you know, you've had some serious pullbacks in 2010 and 2011. But the other thing that I think is kind of unique, and it represents a real sea change from what was happening, say, 5 to 10 years ago, is the fact that one of the things we look at are 90% days. A 90% day is defined as on a 90% up day, up volume represents 90% or more of total up-down volume. And we also follow things, something called points changed, points gained and points lost, which are really a compilation of the points gained and points lost and only advanced and declining issues on the New York Stock Exchange on a day-to-day basis. That also should be showing points gained as 90% or more of points gained, points lost. same thing goes for the downside, where it would be a 90% down volume and points lost. There has been none since the initial move off the November low. And you contrast that, you know, people talk about the impact of algorithmic trading and rapid fire, you know, high frequency trading. July 2007, the SEC did away with the uptick rule, right? Can't short a stock. Well, I've got an uptick in order to short a stock. They did away with that. And there was an explosion of 90% days after that. I think probably in 2008, we had, I don't know, 35 or 40 of them. And he continued into the initial phase of the bull market, where in 2009, 2010, I think we had like 20, 25, something in that order. We have had none, zero, which, again, I find amazing that, you know, we have had some of those very sharp declines in the market, no 90% days. And the other thing has been about the advance that you've seen. You mentioned a melt-up. Well, a melt-up is really two factors. It's not just price, but it's what's behind the price. A melt-up is simply the modern variation of what we used to call panic buying or a buying climax. That includes volume as well. And you'd expect to see, you know, a 90, 95% up volume. You'd expect to see, I think we're averaging about 3.2 billion shares a day right now. You'd expect to see 5, 6 billion shares. That's your melt-up. That's your classic melt-up. Hasn't happened. Have we had big gains in price? Yes. I mean, look what the Dow has done just over the last month, running out ahead of the S&P, the New York. But it's been on very, very modest up volume. One of the things that, you know, you ask about what was sort of unique about this market, and something I've been talking about with the folks here, is that this rally has been very orderly. There hasn't been, you know, any kind of big dislocations, as we've mentioned. It hasn't been as much as a 3% pullback. It's been very orderly, and there's been no indication of the kind of panic that, oh, you know, I've got to get on now before the train leaves the station kind of attitude. There's been none of that. The market's been rallying. Up volume's been running, you know, 50%, 60, 65%. That's been it. So, you know, there has been nothing out there that would suggest that people are panicking into the market. That would, in fact, represent a melt-up, and where you'd say, okay, you know, now we're setting the stage for possibly not a major top, but certainly a, you know, a significant retracement of the intermediate-term rally. You know, so pull back, you know, 5%, 8%, maybe even 10% down. Hasn't happened.
And as you take a look at that, I mean, is it just people putting money in their 401ks every single paycheck period? I mean, where's the money coming from that's driving these prices up in whatever way they are going up, even though it, as you say, it isn't a lot of panic buying? Is it just, hey, I need to be in the market and there's no other better place to be?
Rates are still very low. I mean, they're getting a little bit more competitive with the, say, the dividend yield on the S&P. But, you know, success tends to breed success, and people look at what's going on in the market, and, you know, there hasn't been any kind of significant pullback. So you say, okay, where can I put my money? Well, I can put it into 10-year notes, and I can get, you know, 2.4%. I can do 2.4% in, you know, 4 or 5 weeks in the market. Why bother? So I hesitate to say that the fear factor has gone, because sentiment, except among people like us, the market letter writers, who are wildly bullish right now, sentiment has been still pretty subdued. One of the things that you can look at is the percent invested by the National Association of Independent Investment Advisors, NAIIM. It's running around 75% right now. Early in the year, you actually had leverage. It was about 102%. Right now, it's, you know, I say it's about 75%, I think, was the latest reading, which is, you know, sort of plain vanilla. So there isn't that over-enthusiasm that you expect to see in the market. But at the same time, you know, there's really not any great fear coming out of the market. So, you know, I think people just said, look, you know, just keep on putting money gradually into the market. And, you know, next thing you know, you've made a nice gain.
Well, on the Friday we're talking, the government just reported economic growth hit 3.1% for the third quarter, two quarters of 3% economic growth. Richard, that is something we have not seen much of in these last 8 years. So looks like firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, I mean, I think the emphasis in the market certainly has shifted from income to growth. You know, you've seen growth, for instance, as a investment style outperform value for much of this year. And I think people are looking towards earnings. The expectations for tax cut, what kind of benefit that will accrue to corporate earnings, I think is definitely playing a role in this. And it's a reason why we should be paying very close attention to earnings. I mean, you just earlier in the program alluded to the big gains you've seen in some of these technology stocks, you know, obviously Amazon, Alphabet, Microsoft today. Big gains, and they, with the media hyperbole, they crushed earnings. And so definitely earnings are a major role in this market, and it's something for people to keep an eye on in terms of, you know, are they continuing to expand? Are they starting to slow down? What's happening, particularly if a company exceeds their earnings and then goes down in price? That is a sign, certainly, that the price has already discounted these earnings expectations. That's a bad sign. Hasn't happened so far, not to any degree. And again, going back to today.
Yeah, and actually earnings could improve. Maybe the excitement today, too, is the possibility of tax reform, which would lower corporate tax rates from 35 to 20%. That's going to add to earnings if that indeed does get passed. Richard, as we close, if listeners would like to find out, perhaps you can tell them a little bit about the newsletter that you put out. And you guys have been doing this for quite some time. You follow not only the major markets and various indicators, but you also follow different sectors of the market as well as international. Tell them a little bit more about your letter.
The way people access our information is through our websites. We have several different levels of subscribing, from a weekly newsletter to a very comprehensive global analysis and domestic analysis with hundreds of charts and daily commentaries on the market, on sectors, on ETFs, that sort of thing. So it's sort of something there for about anybody if they are interested in following the market from a technical perspective, which is our specialty.
I might add, you guys have been doing it longer than anybody I know.
1938 is when Mr. Lowry started, and our data goes back to 1925.
Give out your website, if you would, as we close, if our listeners would like to get in contact with you.
Sure. The easiest thing to do is just type in Lowry On Demand. That's Lowry, and then On Demand is one word. And that should bring you up with a link to our website, and you can take a trial subscription. You can have a tour of exactly, you know, what's available on these different levels of the subscription and get a feel for exactly all the various tools we offer.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining us is Robert Strauss. He is a practicing attorney, and he's also a teacher of advanced estate planning at UCLA's Extension. Robert, let's begin with the repeal of estate taxes. You know, that has been brought up in the past, and the last time they talked about it, they worked out a compromise in the Obama administration, raising the exemption to $5 million, but there was a period of time when we really didn't know which way it was going. I'd like to get your take on this. What is the probability they lower estate taxes or eliminate them completely?
It's a very good question and a really challenging question to answer definitively. Here's my take on it. We find ourselves at an interesting point in time, which seems to be in many ways similar to where we found ourselves in 2001, when the second President Bush took power, and he at that point had proposed repealing the estate tax. And the Republicans had a majority in the Senate and the House, just like they do now. In fact, Republicans had an even larger majority in the Senate at that time. I believe they had 58 seats, whereas now they have 52 seats. So it was a Republican-controlled government, and they wanted to repeal the estate tax. And what actually happened was that they couldn't get the votes to repeal the estate tax. What we've noticed, I think, all of us in the country, no matter what side of the aisle we're on, is that there's less cooperation between Republicans and Democrats now than ever before, and especially going back to 2001. And as a consequence, I think everybody who practices in the area of estate planning would recognize that if estate tax repeal would come to a vote on a standalone basis, There just aren't the votes to repeal it.
Well, oil prices have been having difficulty this year. We've gotten over 50, but it seems like every time we get to 52, the price of oil comes back. On this Friday, oil is breaking out, finally, at around $53 for West Texas Intermediate crude. Joining us on the program is Kurt Wolf from McDepp.com. Kurt, looks like, if you go back to midsummer, since June, oil has been on an uptrend. The stocks took off in August, but recently, as we've seen the price of oil take off at the beginning of October, it seems like the oil stocks, at least as you take a look at the ETF like the XLE, it's been drifting downward. Anything behind that, or you just think this is year-end tax selling?
No, I don't think it's tax selling. I'm not sure I can, well, who knows what it is, but my perspective is that the first two quarters of the year weren't too great for our stocks, but the third quarter was good, but in the fourth quarter, we're probably slipping a little bit. All year long, for the most part, at least for the last 8 months, price of oil has been around $50, price of natural gas has been around $3, up and down a little bit. It's actually been a period of pretty low volatility compared to what we've been through at other times. So I think we're in a transition here that the supply and demand are balancing out, and we're getting into a very attractive period here for the price to move up on a cyclical basis. The economic cycle is good. The earnings growth has been 3% for two quarters in a row now. I'm not an expert on whether those numbers can be maintained, but we do see more economic activity. Seasonally, we're ahead of the winter. The winter is usually the stronger demand month for oil and gas around the world. Summer is better for gasoline in the U.S. The charts are starting to look good. We have a half dozen of my stocks are now trading past the Golden Cross, where the 50-day average goes above the 200, and ConocoPhillips just joined that. I've got some positive stocks, and the positive stocks are mostly the very big stocks, which also pay dividends, and a couple small stocks that pay big income. But most of the other stocks that are, think of growth stocks, shale oil and shale gas growth stocks, they're still not perking up very much.
Yeah, this kind of surprised me, because if you take a look at earnings for the S&P this year, which are up, a good portion of those earnings increases is coming from the energy sector. I mean, if you take a look at where we were last year, a big, big improvement with a lot of the oil companies. In fact, the Wall Street Journal did an article that the cash flow for these, especially the big five companies, has been incredible. So things are improving all across the board. You just wonder at some point, when do investors really jump on board this and ride this train? Because it looks like it's left the station.
Leaving the station. I think the market as a whole has been very strong. So I see people who are maybe a little nervous about the overall market, and they like to find something that hasn't participated yet. And certainly oil qualifies on that score. And it often oil is often a little more exciting towards the end of the economic cycle, after we've had some good demand and the prices start to firm up. So that's the stage that we seem to be in now, although we hope the economic cycle doesn't end right away. And so on a supply and demand side, you can look at much better inventory charts now than we had previously. Crude oil is now back within the five-year range. Natural gas is tracking the midpoint of the five-year range here in the U.S. Demand for gasoline is up over the previous year. Distillates down a little bit. Crude oil and product exports are booming. Last week, we exported almost 2 million barrels a day, and we're doing 6 million barrels a day, I think, on products. And on natural gas, we're exporting to Mexico. We're exporting LNG, and another big LNG plant's coming on in the next few months. There's a lot of demand for U.S. oil and gas outside the country, and that tends to tighten it up a little bit here in the country. But it's taken a long time to get to a more balanced inventory situation, and I hope that's where we are right now. More balanced, and then if things are strong, it can tighten up.
OPEC has a meeting coming up here very soon, and there's a talk about extending the production cuts beyond March. Now they're talking about the end of the year. They're worried a little bit if they end in March, we're not quite there.
So what do you think are the possibilities they do go to the end of next year just for safety? And then, of course, you have the IPO of Aramco, which seems at least the Saudis are saying that's still on. What impact do you think that will have if, let's say, next month OPEC says, you know, we're going to keep these things in place till the end of next year?
Yeah, I don't claim to have great insight, and there are a lot of things that can go one way or the other. But, you know, I've been watching some of the interviews at the conference in Saudi Arabia this week, held by the Crown Prince, and they seem to be determined to diversify their economy, and lots of people are there hoping to make or have promised investments. And the money for the diversification is going to come from the Aramco IPO. And that all makes a lot of sense, and people are excited about it. So it looks to me like the IPO is on track, and as long as that's the case, presumably Saudi Arabia will work to keep oil prices at least at the current level. It doesn't take too much to do that because the spare capacity around the world is only a million barrels a day or something like that.
You know, the other thing, too, is at some of the recent conferences, if you listen to the earnings call by some of the CEOs of companies, recently the head of British Petroleum said, we're draining the pool. So that seems like inventories are falling in line, which is going to help the price of oil. Kurt, I want to talk a bit about something that you don't hear too much about, and that is during the downturn, when we went from $100-something a barrel, we got down to 60, and then, of course, we got down last year where we got down to the low 20s, there was worry about the companies that they were going to be able to maintain their dividends. And I'm talking about the big guys, whether you're looking at Total, whether you're looking at Royal Dutch, Chevron, or Exxon. But those dividends were maintained throughout the downturn. In fact, several companies increased them. They didn't increase them by very much, but they did increase them. But as a result of that, two things that strike me. Number one, they've slashed employment in this sector. The figures I read are close to 200,000 individuals have been let go. And you know, Kurt, you just don't flip a switch and those people come back into the sector. They cut back on major projects in order to conserve cash flow, maintain the company's finances. But as a result of cutting back, what about the implications for that in the future? Because an oil company sells oil, they have to go out and replace that oil sooner or later. Otherwise, the warehouse begins to get empty. You know, and then the other aspect is depletion of a regular oil well, whether it's shale or it's a big field offshore or someplace else. What implications do you think this has longer term? It seems to me this is going to be, even though we're in a glut or have been, there's a possibility down the road we could have some tightness in the oil market.
Yeah, I think you described it pretty well. Those are cyclical forces that have really struck with a vengeance in the oil and gas business. The people that have been laid off are the people who develop the new supply, the oil field service and equipment part of the industry. That's the capital equipment side. They've been laid off. Unemployment is fairly low around the economy as a whole. And with growth, there'll be more jobs elsewhere. So they won't come back. They won't come back that fast. And of course, when you do bring new people back in, then the efficiency of the operation is not nearly as good as it is when you only have the core group of people working on it. But what you describe, of course, is, you know, that's where we're headed. You know, we're headed for tightening. Now, if we have normal demand, I think we will get some tightening on the supply. If we have, you know, if we have a weak economy, you know, some people still argue for deflation rather than inflation. And if we're going to have a weak economy around the world, then, of course, oil will suffer a bit, too. I don't think we're going down a lot, but we're not going up under those circumstances. But I think we have to be more optimistic about economic activity. We certainly can be today. And more economic activity is more demand for oil, and there's less supply because of all these people that have been laid off and the reduction in activity in terms of developing new supply.
Let's talk about the companies themselves. As we were mentioning earlier, a lot of the big companies, there was worries about dividend cuts. That did not happen. Some of them are now starting to increase. As the Wall Street Journal talked about the other day, I think the big five earned almost $34 billion in cash or more in the last quarter. I don't know what it is for this current quarter, but what do they do with that money? Do you see them increasing dividends, or eventually are they going to have to start putting that money into drilling again and finding new prospects?
There's a very strong psychology or push in the industry to prove what they're doing is worthwhile. You know, to return some money to the shareholders. We got all this money tied up in oil and gas companies, but we don't know if we're going to make anything on it because we don't know what the future oil price is. So companies have been emphasizing how much money they're actually returning to shareholders. This is kind of like what it was back in the early 80s when after the run-up during the 70s, there were some the big companies looked like their stocks were pretty cheap and they weren't regarded as very well managed. They became takeover candidates. Well, now the companies have to prove themselves that they can generate cash flow at current prices, pay that cash flow back to the shareholders. So that's a big emphasis, a big theme for all the companies that have been successful in the stock market this year. Because the big companies have returned, well, the dividends have gone up, as you say, but they've cut back a lot. And this is the other side of it. People who own these stocks are putting pressure on the companies to cut back. So the companies have cut back so that they could pay out more of that cash flow to the shareholders, more dividends and stock buybacks, paying down debt. And even so, the big companies have done that. The smaller companies are working in that direction. Some of the stuff, well, a company like Occidental pays a pretty good dividend. And not a great stock, but it looks like it's going to be making its golden cross here before too long with all the cash flow it's returning to shareholders. And then we got these little income stocks that are doing well this year, and they pay out all of their free cash flow. So free cash flow has been kind of a free cash flow means the cash flow that exceeds what's being spent on a business has become a mantra for companies this year. I think basically companies are proving that they can be economically viable and successful at $50 oil. They may not be big growth stocks at $50 oil, but they're good rate of return stocks.
That's interesting because in a market, despite the fact that the Fed has raised interest rates, dividend yields on stocks are a little over 2%, and we're still in a low interest rate environment, despite the fact the Fed has raised interest rates and is likely to do so again at the end of the year. I'm surprised, the one great thing about some of these big oil stocks, they're known as kind of like solid dividend paying stocks. And if you take a look at any big company, I don't care if you're looking at Exxon, Chevron, you mentioned Oxy, a lot of these companies have dividend yields, Kurt, that are, you know, you take a look at Exxon, it has a yield of 3.7, Chevron's over 4. I mean, when you compare that to 2% treasuries or 2% overall on the S&P 500, it really stands out.
Yeah, I think that's always been their residual strength, so to speak. The big dividend payers, good income stocks. If you're running an income fund, you typically will own some oil and gas stocks.
What's interesting about this is, you know, when you invest in a company like Google, Facebook, Amazon, you're obviously going for growth. With resource stocks, that was sort of an emphasis in the last decade because the price of oil was moving from $20 a barrel at the beginning of the century all the way up to almost $150 in the summer of 2008. But typically when you think of resource stocks, you don't think of them as a growth story as you would, for example, a Facebook or an Amazon or a Google. So perhaps one of the reasons that we see these high dividends in these companies, it is a way for, let's say, management to reward shareholders. And that's one of the distinctions that really stands out when you look at this sector as a group.
Yeah, and I think that's the nature of oil and gas production. It takes a lot of investment to get the oil and gas production going. And investors are probably most interested at the time when people are putting more money into developing new supply. But once that supply is developed, it typically lasts a long time, generates a lot of cash. And so investors who are interested in growth, if they don't see that cash growing, they don't see the exciting opportunity. But if you actually do generate that cash and you get it in your own hands, that turns out to be a pretty nice rate of return.
Kurt, you follow the sector. You follow the large cap stocks, the mid cap stocks, and some of the smaller cap stocks along with the income trust. Have you found in a business cycle at any one time that one sector outperforms the other? In other words, I would suspect in economic weakness or let's say a slowing economy, you might want to be with the big guys because it's kind of like the blue chips. You stay with the blue chips. If the economy is booming or growing strongly like it is now, do the mid-tiered stocks or the income stocks outperform? Have you found any relationship with the business cycle and the performance within the sector itself?
Yeah, there's a pretty strong relationship this year with the as we started out in our conversation, the income payers The big stock income payers are doing well this year. And among my small stocks, those that pay a lot of income are doing better. But all those stocks that are, you know, that really were responsible for a lot of the excitement in shale oil and shale gas, developing all this new supply, those stocks, which and some of they've been great growth stocks, they're still out of favor. They haven't come back yet, and some of them are still down quite a bit this year. So I think the I don't really know how to call the cycles, Jim. I haven't got a good answer to that question. What I do is I own a lot of the big ones, and I own some of the small ones, and I spread my money around. So it's not. In spreading my money around, the money that's in the stock market is all doing very well. The money that's in the big oil companies is okay. And the money that's in the small oil companies is getting killed. But I stick with it because I think that'll turn. The oil price, they're very sensitive to oil price.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at what OPEC's doing. I'm watching the inventory levels. I'm watching tanker traffic. And everything looks like this thing is turned. It's almost like this sector, Kurt, reminds me of an aircraft carrier. You know, if you're in a speedboat, you can turn on a dime. But if you're an aircraft carrier, it takes a while to turn the ship around, and it looks like that ship is turning. If you were an investor right now, would you do exactly what you're doing, which is you have some money in the big stocks, you have some money in the mid-tier, and you have some money in the small stocks. In other words, spread it around so you're not dependent on just a handful of stocks, but diversified a bit. Or would you be better off just, for example, if you don't do the kind of a rigorous analysis that you do, buy something like an ETF?
You could probably do just as well in an ETF as you could be in my stocks, because that's been hard to differentiate performance by companies. And there are two big ETFs. One is the XLE, the Spider, the part of the S&P 500 that's in the energy business. And then there's the Vanguard Energy Fund, which is pretty diversified. I won't repeat the symbol because I'm not sure of it. But the Vanguard Energy Fund has a lot of stocks in it, and they would have some more of the smaller companies as well as the big companies. If you bought a mix of my stocks, big and small, you wouldn't do a lot different than the ETF. But on the other hand, you know, if you're really looking at a stock, if you want to own stocks rather than a big fund, then you can look at my research and try to decide a good entry point for one particular stock or another. That's pretty much what I do, is I try to rank the stocks on a valuation basis, and there is some differentiation on timing that you can do. But if you're a long-term investor, the timing washes out after a while.
Yeah, you're doing something that, Kurt, is rarely done on Wall Street. So much of the market today is done with passive indexing funds and algorithmic trading. And it just, you know, the rigorous kind of stock analysis of value, what is a company worth, is you don't see that done too much anymore. If somebody would like to get into individual stocks and they want to find out more about them, tell them about your website, would you?
Sure. My website is mcdepp.com. And you can get all of my research. It's publicly available after a delay. I send it to my clients first. And you can find some analysis every week. Some of these stocks we talked about, the big stocks like, which have done well this year, Total and ConocoPhillips and Suncor, I have recent pieces on them in my work. I've got something on all of 25 stocks. They're ranked by value. So I use my MacDepp ratio. MacDepp is market cap and debt. The securities value, so to speak, over present value, with the resource value of the company. And those that are cheaper or have a lower ratio tend to do better over time. But, you know, some of those with a higher ratio, if they're really good companies, they tend to do well, too. But my personal view is I can't really buy a stock unless I've got some kind of idea what it's worth. Now, my idea of what it's worth is the subject to error, but at least I would have some confidence that I was buying something that it was real.
Well, it's almost like a dying industry. You don't find too many individuals doing what you do.
I am 77 years old, so.
Well, a lot of good experience behind that. Kurt, I want to thank you for coming on the program. And once again, Kurt's website is MacDepp. That's MCDEP.com. A lot of great information if you're looking at individual companies. Kurt, thanks so much for joining us.
Yep, thanks for the call, Jim. Good to talk to you.
Municipal bonds seem to be a popular method of investments, but now I have a question for you. Are they actually safe? What is the state of the states who are offering municipal bonds to the public. Because if we run into a downturn, will they be able to back the bonds? Coming up next, we'll talk about that on The Big Picture, as well as the rising economy. We're above 3% for the third quarter, according to government figures, which we haven't seen in 8 years. And of course, with a rise in economy, it's a rise in the demand for oil. We'll be talking about that next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.